So we're going to, so tonight we're going to talk about several parts of this, both the context, the historical context of our working against Islamophobia, the impacts, indirect impacts of Islamophobia on the Muslim community, and then we're going to dive into the specific work and the ways that you as an ally can combat Islamophobia in the community. And we're going to be, Dina and Mary are going to be presenting for about half an hour, and then we'll have plenty of time for people to ask questions and offer stories. So, Dina, why don't you go ahead and get started?
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Lucy. And thank you all for being on this call. I know we really appreciate your presence and your interest. So as Lucy said, my name is Dina Alifai. Welcome.
It's
like how to deal with it when you're
I'm not interested in that.
Yeah, okay.
You're
going to
watch it.
I'm going to mute everybody, and Dina and Mary, why don't you unmute yourself, okay? Again, one more time. Sorry for that.
The conference has been muted. The conference has been muted.
All right. Sorry about that. And I will speak in case folks are having trouble hearing. So as Lucy said, my name is Dina Rafai. I am the policy fellow here in D.C. for AFSC. I've been in D.C. for about 6 months now and moved here from living in Tennessee for 12 years. So because Tennessee, I'm just kind of going to give an overview of Tennessee and the source of legislation that we saw and just some kind of personal stories. So because Tennessee serves as a testing ground to a lot of racist, xenophobic, anti-Muslim legislation. The environment that I grew up in throughout my middle school, high school, and college years as a Muslim American was largely impacted by the sorts of policies that would surface. So in 2010 and 2011, we saw a lot of mosque opposition in Tennessee, especially for three mosques, one of which was against the mosque my community was advocating for. Our only mosque in the entire city was actually just a rented out space that used to be a bank. And so we really wanted a space for our community to pray in and gather in. But unfortunately, we ended up withdrawing our application to build a mosque in 2011 because of the overwhelming opposition that we experienced. There was also another mosque that garnered a lot of opposition, and it was the Murfreesboro Mosque, which some of you may have heard about. It actually ended up getting national attention and had a CNN documentary done on it. excuse me. This mosque was actually subject to arson, bomb threats, and vandalism as it was being built. Opponents of the mosque even took their fight all the way to the Supreme Court 2 years after the mosque had already opened. But thankfully, the Supreme Court declined to hear the case. There were also a slew of anti-Sharia bills that came up in 2011 that would have essentially criminalized basic Muslim practices, such as praying or washing your feet in public as acts of, it would have labeled them as acts of treason. The bill would have given the Attorney General full authority to investigate complaints of quote-unquote Sharia followers and decide who's practicing it. I remember the real fear that many of us felt as we thought about whether someone like me who wears hijab and was a high school student could be locked up for wearing hijab or praying. And this was, of course, all part of a deliberate push to alienate and demonize Muslims and all part of the $57 million industry that fuels Islamophobia. But I also remember committing to resistance as a high school student. And many of us vowed to pray in public in masses and wrap our hijabs tighter should we see a bill like this passed? So being exposed to this at a young age, as well as being an Egyptian American who around the same time, so in 2011, when the Arab Spring and the Egyptian Revolution started, I was seeing my people rise up against oppressive and dictatorial regimes and take to the streets with their demands and push for social justice, and my passion for social justice just kind of continued to grow. In summer of 2013, I was in Egypt visiting family and witnessed the world around me bleeding as one of the world's largest killings of demonstrators in a single day in recent history occurred, known as the Rabaa Massacre. As close to 1,000 of protesters were killed in that day, and over 2,000 were killed in total. And then in summer of 2014, so the summer after that, in America, we witnessed the Black Lives Matter movement start in Ferguson. And I joined protests in Ferguson in October of 2014, and then days later, my uncle in Egypt was targeted and imprisoned because of the unjust and repressive Egyptian tactics that seek to essentially stifle opposition to the government by criminalizing Muslims. So something that fits into the pattern of criminalizing a group of people as a means of repression and control. And we've seen this happen throughout history, specifically in the U.S. and particularly with Black-led movements. So all of these experiences have really pushed me towards social justice and analyzing the ways that these oppressions, I kind of mentioned my family in Egypt, as well as experiences I've had in Tennessee, as well as the being part of the, you know, experiences and movement in Ferguson. All of these kinds of experiences have helped me analyze the ways that these oppressions are connected globally. And I have these eyes for resisting a larger system of colonialism, imperialism, state violence, and repression, which I think is what our resistance now, it's critical for it to look like. And kind of reflect that resistance of a larger system of repression and state violence. So with that, I will turn it over.
Great. Thank you so much, Dina. This is Mary. And I think I'll just back it up a little bit and just kind of give you a sense of how we started this project. Lucy mentioned I work with the Wage Peace Network at AFSC, and many of the offices around the country who were part of the Wage Peace Network who'd done work on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan developed relationships with Muslim community during those many years of protests, but had kind of ceased doing work with them until in 2015. At the end of 2015, there was, I think 30 U.S. governors who decided to bar Syrian refugees from their states. And many of those same programs, you know, kind of reestablished relationships with the groups that they had worked with in the Arab and Muslim community to protest this. And so that rose, that kind of led to a discussion within our network of, you know, just trying to figure out, you know, what we could do in response, feeling like there was real energy in our communities for addressing this, but feeling like we wanted to do some kind of work that, that, you know, certainly built from the interface support for refugees work, but kind of went further into supporting these communities. So we have been meeting, and we started to work on this project probably about a year ago to really reach out to local partners, hear from them what they thought would be useful. And our project ultimately has a long-term goal of reducing profiling and surveillance in the Muslim community in the cities where we're doing this project, which is Chicago, Indianapolis, Cambridge/Boston, and Northampton around Western Mass. And then we have a couple other cities, because we have staff in those cities who are interested, who I think will start to do some of this work too. I'm hearing that we might be doing some workshops in Philly. I think Dina may be interested in doing some in D.C. We've got a couple of other cities across the U.S. who may do some of this as well. But that's our long-term goal, and certainly in this crazy Trump era, there have been many things to oppose, and will be, and we can get into that a little bit later. But in our short-term goal, I think makes perfect sense for right now, and again, we've kind of established this before the election, but our short-term goal is to train hundreds of people to become better allies to the Muslim community. One of the things that was identified for us early on in this sort of consultation process with the community was that there were plenty of people who they knew were really on their side, but who didn't feel confident, weren't really showing up for them the way that they needed them to, weren't really speaking out. And their feeling was that people just didn't have the analytical tools, didn't have the skills, didn't have the language to effectively, interrupt Islamophobia on many different levels. So that's what we're trying to do. We're going to train up hundreds of people in this time period. We're going to engage these folks who come to the trainings in Muslim-led work, following the lead of the people who are affected by this issue, and then hopefully develop 5 to 10 leaders from within each city to really lead deeper engagement. So that gives you a sense of that. And just to mention that our goals for the training are, and this is what we'll probably talk more about the rest of the period, is just this, what is the training about? But we're trying to develop an analysis of anti-Muslimism beyond individual acts. So people may think of the personal harm level, like street harassment or rude comments or things like that, but we really also want people to think about state-level violence, so the policies and institutional practices that profile and surveil and otherwise oppress the Muslim population. And also, we really are working on trying to move the idea of allyship for people. So many people approach being an ally as though, just thinking, and this is a good thing, that your individual acts are really important. So, like, how am I standing up to say, hey, you can't say that racist thing, and that's a really good thing. How can I help? And we know that's where many people start, and we think that's good, and we want to move them to thinking about what's being asked of me from the community. And so maybe that your help is more valuable in lots of different ways, but you need to listen to the affected community and support movements led by the affected community. So that's a piece about allyship that we've been working on, and I think Dina can probably say a little bit more about it.
Yeah, so as part of our training, we kind of have specific handouts that we distribute, and just kind of an idea of what allyship looks like and what taking, as Mary said, what taking cues and leadership from the impacted community looks like. And so we actually, there is a piece by Hoda Katebi, is one of our partners in Chicago, called 5 Things to Remember, and it's a really great piece that we kind of developed materials from and definitely look to. And I guess I'll just kind of give a summary of that because we found it really helpful, and a lot of folks in the trainings, I think, have also have found it helpful and appreciated it. So I think the most important thing to remember as an ally is that we kind of have to make sure that we're not perpetuating the microaggressions against those who are against those who we are trying to support, especially those in which we have maybe little experience working with. So there's kind of a list of things to remember, if you will. So one is asking yourself, who asked me? So decisions on what solidarity looks like should come from the people who you want to be in solidarity with. So making sure that our acts of allyship and solidarity are centered in the needs of the impacted, and not on our own feelings of, you know, our own vision of solidarity or our own maybe feelings of guilt. The impacted community kind of, it's important to be consulting with them and organizing solidarity actions. And then two is not replicating oppressive systems. So if our solidarity and allyship replicates the same rhetoric that, for instance, the U.S. uses to justify military occupation, such as hijab-wearing women are weak and in need of physical saving, then essentially that's problematic and is perpetuating the same kind of oppressive narrative and system. And then there's also holding ourselves accountable and, you know, making sure that we have constant self-awareness and self-assessment and constantly learning and unlearning and owning up to our mistakes and lack of knowledge on something and just really listening to the impacted community and, you know, yielding the floor to the impacted community and centering the impacted community. And then also lastly is kind of knowing that being an ally is full-time and that it's a long-term commitment. So really showing up for the impacted community and forming relationships with the impacted community is key, as well as understanding the complexities and interconnectedness of oppressive systems and really building kind of solidarity through that and building the work when realizing that the systems are, you know, that oppressive systems are interconnected. Essentially, it kind of builds solidarity through the movement. So that's just kind of some things about allyship towards the impacted community.
Yeah, and one more thing I'd say about how we're thinking about allies is that we haven't, in some groups that do ally training are actually keeping it specifically like white people only, but we're not thinking of it that way because we found in starting to do this work that people from other marginalized communities are really interested in this particular training because they want to learn too and they want to be able to show up for the Muslim community. So, you know, we did a training in Chicago last night. It was extremely diverse in many ways, including by race and ethnicity. And you know, and that's one of the things we talk about in the training, too, is that Muslim people have multiple identities. And anti-Muslimism or Islamophobia affects multiple identities, including people who may not be Muslim. They may just be perceived to be Muslim. They may be from a country of origin that's majority Muslim. They may be, you know, multiple identities. So anyway, we're looking at the idea of allyship in a broad way. I guess just to pick up a little bit more about what we are doing in the training, this project is part of AFSB's focus on trying to change the narrative around foreign militarism. And so we do some narrative change practices within the training, and it's actually a really great way to begin to unpack what Islamophobia actually is. So one of the first things that we do, and it's uncomfortable for people to have to do this, is we get people into groups, small groups, and we ask them to articulate myths, common assumptions, or beliefs that people have around Islam and Muslims. And you know, as I said, it can be pretty uncomfortable, but it's important to put those things on the table. And I, because I did a training last night, I'll just read you some of the things the group in Chicago came up with. Number one is that Islam is inherently anti-Christian. Number two is that Muslims and Islam are inherently anti-woman, misogynist, and homophobic. Number three is that Islam is inherently violent. Number four is that all Muslims are terrorists, except for the quote-unquote good ones. Number five is that Islam is anti-American and opposed to Western life. And number six is that all Muslims are foreigners, Arab, and exotic. So what we do is we take those myths or beliefs, and then we really start to work on them a little bit. And eventually it's very clear these are narratives because we unpack them, how those same myths or beliefs are expressed through the media, And then we take those narratives and we say, okay, these narratives, they're in the media. You've probably learned some of them in school. You've seen them in movies, like Disney movies, you know, all kinds of movies. These narratives are really strong, and they have historical precedent, too, when we go into that. But we say then we try to unpack a little bit of what kind of harm do they create. And so we look at that harm from both the individual level, but then, again, like also the state violence or institutional policy level. And, again, I'll just kind of give you – I'll take one, like the narrative that Islam is inherently violent. And, again, you know, AFSB's mixed messages report that we put out, you know, found that anytime the media mentions violent extremism, whether or not it has anything to do with Muslims or Islam, they always mention Islam. So it could be, you know, about some white Christian extremism, but they'll still mention, you know, ISIS in the story or whatever. But anyway, you take that narrative, okay? So if people really believe that that's true, buy into that narrative, what kind of harm can that create at the individual level? And, you know, people mentioned street harassment, preemptive arrests, beatings, killings, job discrimination, social stigmatization, you know, at the individual level. And then at the state violence level, you know, people thought of the global war on terror, drone strikes, the Muslim ban, arrests, incarceration, entrapment, surveillance. So, you know, many of the policies that we've seen in the last couple of years, and then also there's many policies, you know, that are proposed that would exacerbate the situation under a Trump administration. And at deeper into the training, we go into ways to interrupt those harms, that harm, at both the individual and the state violence level. And I'll just mention a couple of the things. Part of the training is we do a bystander training, which I think a lot of groups are doing now, but ours is a little bit different because what we really try to say is the most important thing is to take your cues from the individual who's being harassed. We have a whole handout about this on our website, which I encourage you to take a look at. But, you know, we say the thing that many of the bystander trainings make it really clear, like make sure that you are, your presence as a witness is known. Make sure that the person being harassed knows you're there to support them. However, you can do that with trying to keep people safe. But, again, taking your, take your cues from that person. So is this person engaging the harasser, you know, and, you know, or not, you know, and you can kind of make suggestions, but kind of follow their lead. If the person is really handling it on their own, they don't need your help, and you can kind of just be there, let them know you're there, you have their back. But if they're engaging the person and taking care of themselves, then that's fine. You know, and make sure to, if they do need your help, to, you know, ask questions to try to distract or get yourself, but get both of you out of the space into somewhere that's safe. But the other thing that we really emphasize is to not call the police unless the person being harassed is asking you to, because, you know, targeted communities are sometimes more in danger if you call the police. So we emphasize that there's lots of different things you can do other than calling the police. Of course, if a person asks you to, do it. But if not, you may be causing greater damage and putting that person in greater danger. You know, don't escalate the situation and just simply don't do nothing. It's really important to not be silent because it communicates approval. So we, in our training, we kind of go through those points, but then we kind of role play and kind of try to practice intervening. And I think it's a powerful piece of the training. And then we go into looking at how, what are some ways that you can intervene in the state level harm, and I think Dina's going to address that a little bit.
Yeah. So I think essentially what's most kind of important to recognize, I think, in terms of, you know, policy level is that the government really sets a precedent through its policies on how a specific group or community should be treated. So I think it's important to recognize that because if you look at, you know, for instance, if the government is only viewing Muslims through a national security lens and only seeing us as, you know, capable of belonging to only one of two groups, either as, you know, potential terrorists or as potential informants, then society then kind of takes cues to be suspicious of the Muslim community and justifies the violence that is inflicted on them. And so kind of looking at this political and social climate that we're in now with, you know, Donald Trump as the president of America and with the surge in hate crimes after the election surpassing, you know, that which was even experienced by Muslims post 9/11, it's important to analyze the ways in which we can be interrupters to both interpersonal violence, as Mary said, but also interrupters and disruptors to systemic and state-level violence that is maintained and perpetuated by institutionalized Islamophobia. So it's important to kind of talk about the social construction of terrorism and the specific way that Muslims are seen as perpetrators of violence and the way that this idea has been institutionalized since way before Trump, right? So to talk about this institutionalized Islamophobia is to talk about the deeply embedded anti-Muslim sentiment that thrives in U.S. policies, especially post 9/11. So these policies have included things such as the authorization for use of military force, the National Security Entry Exit Registration System, or NSERS program, that targeted certain Muslim non-citizens for special registration and deportation in 2002 and 2003. The no-fly list that lacks transparency and placed infants and individuals that refuse to be FBI informants onto the list. The communication management units and prisons that are used as forms of isolation explicitly for Muslims. Obama's expansion of the drone program and many, many more that are essentially examples of the state authorizing its own violence through the use of law. And how all of this has normalized Islamophobia and has created the conditions and machinery to give way to Trump and his administration's policies. I think that it's also kind of important to note that institutionalized Islamophobia didn't begin with Trump, nor did it begin 15 years ago, but it actually began, you know, and this is kind of the intersectionality piece. It began the moment the first African Muslims were enslaved and brought to America on slave ships, right? So, in fact, because the enslaved African Muslims were most often the ones that led slave revolts, the Americas actually long ago labeled Islam as dangerous and threatening and labeled Muslims as security risks. And adopted policies to try to convert or ban Muslims from the Americas. And I say that to say two things, really. One is that these policies and this narrative, they're not new. And two, that Islamophobia and anti-Blackness are deeply interconnected. And we see that in the narrative that we see and the policies that we see, specifically in the U.S. In order to really condemn Trump and his policies, we must also include an honest analysis of the normalization of both institutionalized Islamophobia and institutionalized anti-Blackness. It must be intersectional in our analysis of policies and in our resistance to them. So in resisting the policies of Trump, it's important to continue to highlight the intersections between marginalized communities and to call out, again, the larger systems and policies that have long been normalized to create the kind of political environment that we find ourselves in today. So kind of moving to Trump's policies and what's both happening right now and then is to be expected for specifically the Muslim community. Just in the first week of Trump's presidency, we saw executive orders, including the Muslim ban, that have just been, you know, a swift attack on the liberties and lives of Muslims and immigrants. Among other things, we've also seen, or we are reportedly, the Trump administration wants to rebrand Countering Violent Extremism Program, which is a U.S. government program designed to counter all quote-unquote violent ideologies. Trump administration essentially wants to rebrand it and no longer target groups such as white supremacists who carry out shootings and bombings in the U.S. and wants to rebrand it and only focus on Muslims. And lastly, of the most terrifying policies to be expected, the Trump administration is also considering designating the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization, which would subject masses of Muslims to imprisonment and assassination, even if based on unfounded claims of association. In 2013, the repressive government in Egypt declared the Muslim Brotherhood is a terrorist organization, and this is used to justify violent and large-scale repression and unfounded arrests of tens of thousands of people, including my own family members, in order to crack down on opposition. So a United States policy of designating the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization would be used to repress and attack Muslim civil society groups and prominent leaders and activists within the community. This is the policy that would essentially be the Muslim registry, and it would be used to intimidate, silence, and even imprison Muslims, and would give way for other countries to use this as an excuse for political repression. So I think in looking at policies that will be devastating for Muslims, I'm focusing on this one because this is the one that will be used to target Muslims to justify mass repression and imprisonment, and is the one that I fear will most likely impact my family and I directly. So I think kind of having this honest analysis of policy and looking at how these policies would impact the Muslim community specifically will be used to intimidate and repress Muslim civil society. It will be, I think, having that honest analysis is a step towards really resisting them is through having that analysis.
Yep,
with that,
we'll go to Mary. Great, great, thank you. Yeah, I think we're going to move on into Q&A. And I don't know if you have anything to add to that, Mary. That would be great if you did.
Oh, I was just going to add one little thing, just that one of the things that we are learning, too, that we didn't expect is that we're hearing a desire from within the Muslim community for this kind of education for their own community, and feeling that very often marginalized communities are asked to educate white people but don't get to do the political education within their own community. And so we're thinking in Chicago at least about, having like a Muslim-only space that our Muslim co-trainer would organize so that she can do this within the community. So it was an unexpected thing, but I think it would be great to support.
That's great. That's great.
Yeah,
I wanted to add like this to the information about the allyship and the working across different communities to offer allyship and that the concept that Kenyatta came up with in the training of intercultural allyship, where there's a recognition of that your status as a, as a Black American non-Muslim, for example, is more targeted than say a white woman might be, and so how you enter into bystander intervention or some of these ways to interrupt would be sensitive to that and be aware of the way that you might be more targeted. It doesn't mean that you can't do anything. It means that you need to maybe use a different kind of strategy. And I think you talked about, welcoming everybody who wants to be an ally, and that in that process, it's really important to be sensitive to the differentiating a different identity so that people don't put themselves in harm's way while they're trying to interrupt other farms.
Yeah, totally. Thank you for bringing that up. It's exactly right.
Yeah. And so it would be great to, so we're going to open it up to questions, but I wanted to ask first what you're learning as you're doing the training. Obviously, you're learning that just the Muslim community is interested in having some of this as well. If there's anything else, and then I'll, and then for those of you who want to ask questions, if you want to unmute yourself, you can do that by doing *7. If you want to remute yourself, you do *6. And after Mary talks about, Mary and Dina talk about this a little bit, then we'll open it up.
Well, I have another one I could add. Dina, do you have something you want to?
Well, I guess you can go ahead and I'll try to think of it.
Well, just quickly, again, I'm just because I did this training last night, it's fresh in my mind, but one thing that I think is really cool that I think we've found every place we've done it is that people are open to feeling uncomfortable and challenging themselves, which I think is hard, you know, like working through those myths and kind of admitting times when maybe you've been complicit in something because you didn't understand the dimensions of it and all those kinds of things. And we try to create a space where, you know, we're leading with people's intentions, which are good if they're in this space. And so, anyway, just noticing through the evaluations from last night, people felt challenged, but in a way that was constructive. Like they were okay with it. They felt good about it. So that's a learning for me just as a trainer, that it's okay to kind of push people sometimes because you can, some really constructive, good things can come of it, I guess.
Yeah, I think one thing that I've noticed and that I've learned is that, or also has just amazed me, honestly, is the amount of knowledge that's in the room and also how different each group is. And so I think that really kind of exemplifies how each person is really an expert on their own life and on their like experiences, and so how that comes out from each person is really amazing. And honestly, I learn so much like being a co-facilitator of these trainings. Like I'm learning alongside everyone in the room and learning from the people in the room. So I think that's been an amazing experience and something that's really been really cool to see.
Yeah, I just have to kind of echo that and just say, for me, I was on a huge learning curve this entire year working on this project, you know, and working with amazing Muslim women on this project, like Dina and Sophia Sami, who is my co-trainer in Chicago, and working with the Indianapolis co-trainers, Umema and Hadil. But especially really appreciative of Dina's really put the most time into this project, and I've just learned a lot from working with her and just from, you know, the knowledge and life experiences and stories that all of these women have contributed. And I feel like that's why I feel like it's really interesting. I can see where people who are new to this issue, where they're at, because I've learned so much just over the last year. So I think it's been a great experience to be part of.
Great. Yeah, definitely. Thank you both very much for doing this work and for sharing. So we want to open it up to questions. So if you want to have a question, just do *7 and unmute yourself and speak up. Again, *7 if you want to unmute yourself. No question. There must be questions. So I'm going to try to unmute you all, and then you can just speak up if you have a question.
The conference has been unmuted.
Hi, Lucy.
Yeah, go ahead.
This is Susan. I'm only asking a question because everybody was quiet. I so appreciate what you have just shared. It's really amazing thing to learn in the teaching seat, and it's wonderful. When are you talking about doing the training, which is absolutely more vital than it could ever be with Trump's policies?
Susan, you're in Philadelphia, is that right?
I'm in the Philadelphia area, yes.
Okay, great. Well, we're just trying to find a date for that.
Okay, so it will be here then.
Yeah, we're definitely going to do something. Lucy and I have been talking about it. We're just trying to figure out a way to maybe coax Dina to come through, but we're all, super busy. But I definitely will be there, and we'll be figuring it out. But I know we've got somebody on the phone from Indianapolis, and they're starting to roll out trainings in the next couple of weeks. So that's good. And then the other thing is our curriculum. We're still sort of tweaking the curriculum as we do these initial trainings, but the curriculum will be online probably within the next month. And we have a page on the AFIC website, Communities Against Islamophobia, and I think you can find many of our resources also under the Sanctuary Everywhere section.
Great.
Of the AFIC website.
I'm going to mute myself again. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions or comments?
Yeah, this is Lauren from Central Philadelphia, Friends. I'm interested, can you catch me up a little bit on the $57 million industry behind Islamophobia, Dana? I'm still trying to connect the dots on a lot of these things.
Yeah, so I actually got that number from Center for American Progress. They have page called Fear Inc., and they really explore the entire network. So they really map it out. It's actually really amazing. They have the entire kind of like network and the different organizations and I guess players or people that are all part of this network. So again, that's Fear Inc. With Center for American Progress.
Okay, I'm looking that up.
Yeah.
I just want to mention that is a really great report, and it kind of shows how, these people who fund that industry fund think tanks, which then fund experts who were for many years being sort of on the fringe of things, but would get, quoted in mainstream media once in a while. Well, now they're actually part of the administration. I mean, some of these folks, like Mike Pompeo is connected to these folks, who is the CAA director. Chris Kobach, who was the part of the transition team, was the person who helped to craft the executive order. Michael Flynn is gone, but he was also part of that group.
Mm-hmm.
He was on the board of Act for America, which is a viciously anti-Muslim group. Steve Bannon, who, as everybody knows, is chief strategist, was also part of this, scene or whatever, the Islamophobe scene. And Stephen Miller, who people are probably more aware of since his last weird Sunday talk show appearance from last week. And then also Jeff Sessions, who is the Attorney General, has been part of the organized anti-immigrant movement. So these folks have gone from the fringes to the mainstream in this time period.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? The
You were very thorough, I know. if you have any other, and I guess I have a question about communities that you know of or that you've experienced that you think are organized pretty effectively around combating this kind of stuff.
Dina, do you want to mention the new D.C. collective?
Yeah. Well, here in D.C., there's a coalition that is started, I guess, it's been maybe a couple months, called D.C. Justice for Muslims Coalition, and it's led by Muslim women, and they've been organizing teach-ins with the community. So the first event that they had was a teach-in on the Muslim registry and also a teach-in on the NSEERS program for the National Security Entry Exit Registration System, and has had teach-ins on Muslim ban and what that means and how to resist it, has organized actions. So a lot of great work happening in D.C., and it's really also great to see it led by the impacted community. I know that's something that Mary and I have been kind of keep going back to, is the importance of these resistance movements being centered in and led by the impacted community. That's something that's happening in D.C.
And I'd also mention another partner that Gabe Camacho, who is our organizer in Boston, has introduced us to is the Muslim Justice League. And he works very closely with them locally, but they also convene a bunch of groups from around the country who are interested in resisting the Countering Violent Extremism program that Dina mentioned earlier. And that's run by Shannon Al-Wakil. And they just do amazing work and have really brought together, as I said, nationally, a bunch of groups who are locally trying to work on these things. The other thing is that there's really exciting Muslim-led organizing in Minneapolis against those programs, because that was a city where they implemented a lot of them. And then here in Chicago, we are really connected with CARE Chicago, which is the Council on American Islamic Relations, and also the Arab American Action Network, who they were kind of the ones who were leading all of the airport protests in Chicago. So, Sophia Sammy, who works with us, was inspired recently to co-found a collective called the Muslim Organizing Collective, which is led by Muslim women as well. So I think there's a lot of activity that's been around for a while, but then also a lot of new activity that we're excited to support.
Hey, wonderful. Any other questions or comments?
May I ask another question?
Yeah, of course.
Your analysis is extremely advanced, and along with the advanced analysis is language that feels kind of academic. And I was wondering whether it's just me being out of school for so many years that finds it difficult, or whether you're finding in communities that that's also something that needs to be explained.
Yeah, no, I totally appreciate that. And I think when we do a training, you know, if we're compressing 6 hours of knowledge into this very short phone call. So we've probably relied a little bit too much on acronyms. And
oh, no, it was fine. But I'm aware of it on my own work.
Yeah, no, totally excellent point. So the way that we unfold the training is very much based on popular education, so we really look at it as a co-learning community, and we try to, base it from people's own experiences. So it's a real process. So I think we lead people from really basic, you know, from just establishing from group collective knowledge, like what's a basic definition of Islamophobia, through to the very complex analysis of the policies that Gina laid out at the end. but and it takes about 6 hours. So in some places we're doing that like all in one shot, like an entire day, and in other places we're breaking it up into modules where people will come, you know, once a week for 2 or 3 weeks.
Great. Wonderful. Any last thoughts or questions or comments? Great. Well, it's almost the end of the hour. So there's obviously there's the in-person trainings that are in different places around the country. And for those of you who are in Philly, there's going to be one here. There's also, there will be a version of, a shorter version, a 90-minute version of the, some of the workshop at the, AFSG Centennial. Celebration, which is in Philadelphia from April 20th to the 23rd. On the Saturday of that event, there'll be workshops, and this one will be one of them. So that's another opportunity. There's lots of resources on the website if you look for Communities Against Islamophobia, or if you go to the Sanctuary Everywhere page, there's a lot of links from there. And I would encourage everybody to think about this. This is going to be really obviously very, very critical. It's been really encouraging, all of the protests and all of the resistance against the Muslim ban, and it's very clear that there's going to need to be heightened resistance as this executive order, this pretty scary executive order against the Muslim Brotherhood rolls out. So, you know, look at those materials, really think about how you can resist and be part of countering this narrative and working against this pretty scary, obviously not new, but scary policy and practice that's not only obviously in the enacted by the state, but also enacted by individuals who have breathed in these prejudices and this perspective. Take a look. I wanted to really, really thank Dina and Mary for presenting. It's really, really wonderful, deep work and really important. I learned a lot from tonight, and I really appreciate it. This call will be posted. It's been recorded, and it will be posted on the Calls for Spirit of Action page if you want to share it with other people. Our next call next month is going to focus on a new campaign out of our Israel-Palestine work focused on Gaza. It's called the Gaza Unlocked campaign. Mike and Jennifer and at least one other person will be presenting from that on that call. And I hope many of you will join us. And thank you so much for being here and for learning and for all that you each individually and collectively do. It makes a big difference. Dina and Mary, do you have anything that you want to end with before we have a moment of silence?
Just appreciate everybody's time. Thank you so much for your interest.
Yeah, thank you, everyone.
Yeah, thanks for being on the call. So let's close with a moment of silence, and then we'll say goodnight. And the lines are unmuted, so you can just say goodnight as you leave the call. Great. Thanks, everyone, for being here tonight and for all that you're doing. And Dina and Mary, especially, thank you so much. And good night.
Thank you.
Good night. Thank you for having us, Lucy.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you, Dina. And Lucy, thanks for all you do.
Yeah, thanks.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.
Take care, everybody.